You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to the Good News Ride Home for Friday, July 31st, 2020, Harry Potter's 40th birthday. Yep, the boy wizard is officially over the hill. Anyways, I'm Jackson Bird, and today, a medieval potion that apparently still works as an antibiotic. How children's nonsensical emoji use affects their language development, how dogs may be using the Earth's magnetic field to navigate, and the mysterious origins of everyone's favorite song, Who Let the Dogs Out? Here are some of the cool things from the news today. Would you use a 1,000-year-old potion as an antibiotic? It sounds like something from a Goop column, but it's actually being tested by scientists. Bald's Eye Salve, a combination of garlic, onion, wine, and bovine bile, yum, has been shown by researchers at the University of Warwick to be effective against multiple strains of bacteria, according to a new paper in Scientific Reports. Quoting Gizmodo, the new paper, led by Freya Harrison from the School of Life Sciences at the University of Warwick, highlights an underappreciated way of sourcing antibacterial compounds. Many previously effective antibiotic drugs no longer work, as germs are evolving new defenses against them, so it's important to develop alternative strategies. Medieval texts, while a seemingly weird source for medical information, could help in this regard. Plants have been used as medicines against infection for millennia, and we've only scratched the surface in understanding their true potential, said Cassandra Quave, an ethnobotanist at Emory University who wasn't involved in the new research. This study is exciting because it demonstrates how mixtures of specific plant ingredients, such as those found in Bald's Eye Salve, can sometimes work better than individual components in fighting infection, end quote. And the recipe for Bald's Eye Salve comes from Bald's Leech Book, an Anglo-Saxon medical textbook written around the year 905. This latest study follows up on a previous one from the University of Nottingham, which found that the eye salve recipe was effective as an antibacterial compound against Staphylococcus aureus, or MRSA. Quoting again, for the new study, Harrison and her co-authors recreated the brew, testing it against five bacterial strains, including planktonic bacteria and biofilms, the latter being a complex bacterial colony often equipped with antibacterial-resistant attributes. Specifically, Bald's Eye Salve was applied to soft tissue models of infection, including infections of Acinetobacter baumannii, often found in war wounds, Strenotaphomonas maltophilia, commonly linked to lung infections, Staphylococcus aureus, often linked to surgical infections, and Staphylococcus epidermis, associated with infections like tonsillitis, scarlet fever, cellulitis, and rheumatic fever. These bacteria are also found in diabetic foot ulcers, and all have shown varying degrees of resistance to standard antibiotics. Tests of Bald's Eye Salve demonstrated promising antibacterial activity against these bacteria, whether in planktonic or biofilm form, according to the paper. The medieval mixture wasn't harmful to human cells or to mice, which is good news, as it suggests the compound could be reconstituted as an effective treatment for infections, end quote. Now, why it works is still a bit of a mystery. The one thing that researchers are positive of is that it requires the correct combination of all of the ingredients to be effective, not merely one of them individually. And this isn't exactly the first discovery or study of its kind. Last year, Professor Cassandra Quave, quoted earlier in the segment, co-authored a study on medicinal plants that were used during the Civil War, according to a Confederate field guide. These topical remedies derived from white oak, tulip poplar, and devil's walking stick were found to have antiseptic properties. Quave noted that, as weird and hokey as it may sound, looking to the past could be the key to figuring out some of our more challenging roadblocks in our present and future. Quotes, as we look toward a future where many of our current antibiotics may no longer work with the efficacy to which we have become accustomed, I think it's important to have alternative strategies in development to fill that gap. The significance of the study is that it offers another proof of concept case that some of our solutions for the post-antibiotic era may be found in the medical transitions of the pre-antibiotic era. End quote. All that said, please don't go out there and use medieval or even 19th century texts in place of a real modern doctor or pharmacist. These findings could be valuable as one element of future solutions, but don't go trying them on your own just because some guy on a podcast talked about it. If you have young kids in your life in any capacity, you have probably received or found left on your phone a seemingly nonsensical string of emojis, like a lot of emojis, especially animals, shapes, hearts, stars, and poop emojis. It's like a bowl of Lucky Charms spilled all over your texting app. Now, while there are many people out there ready to bemoan emojis as a sure sign of the decline of civilization, and those who at least think that all this screen time can't be healthy for small children and emojis could be detrimental to their language development, Wired's resident linguist Gretchen McCullough has determined that young children's particular type of emoji usage might actually be helping them learn language. She's been doing some informal studies by having people send in the strings of emojis that their kids typed along with their child's age, and has been studying the results. McCullough says, quote, when kids use emoji, it may seem random, a bunch of silly pictures on a screen. But kids start out learning spoken and signed languages in a similar way, by babbling nonsense syllables, which teaches them the rhythm of conversation and trains them to make fine articulatory movements. The silly strings of emoji that kids send could serve a similar purpose. By exposing kids to the rhythm of electronic conversations, emoji may be a useful precursor to reading, a way of acclimating kids to the digital reality of using symbols to communicate with people they care about. End quote. She found that ages 3 to 5 seems to be the peak time for sending emojis, and that the older they are, the more they may have thematic preferences, like one 5-year-old with a clear penchant for any animals that pinch. It's also clear that children use emojis differently than adults, which sounds pretty obvious on its own, but is kind of interesting when you break it down. Quote, overall, the most popular emoji are the face, hand, and heart emoji. While the kids use faces and hearts, hand shapes like thumbs up and prayer hands are not at all common for the younger set. Conversely, the kids use object emoji, like food and animals, far more than adults or teens do. End quote. And perhaps obviously the kids don't use facial expression emojis that offer hints of irony, and their sequenced emojis are much longer without any types of rules that adults may adhere to. Around ages 6 or 7, most kids, as they learn to read, begin aging out of the random string of endless emojis and fully shake it off when they start texting in full sentences, which McCullough points out is a good sign for anyone concerned that emojis are rotting the brains of children and making them incapable of proper grammar. More interestingly, however, she posits that this emoji behavior, when it's actually sent as a text message on someone's phone and elicits a response, might be more useful to language and social development than merely relying on the traditional language learning tools like picture books and alphabet toys. Studies have shown that children learn languages better when they have someone to interact with and don't just passively watch or hear a lesson. When kids text strings of emojis, the adult recipient often responds, sometimes in emojis or in written words, which are read to the child by the person whose phone they sent it on. And this makes it an interactive, customized experience. Quoting again, sending long strings of emoji could be like digital babbling, the nonsense strings that get us used to how our bodies work and how to take turns in a conversation. Think what this is teaching kids about reading and writing. When I was a kid, the written word was a thing of picture books and stop signs and cereal boxes and ABC fridge magnets. Writing often came with colorful, child-friendly illustrations, but it wasn't often created specifically for me. Writing was created by professionals or incorporated into a literacy lesson. Here's a story about talking animals. Here's how you write your name. Writing wasn't used to communicate with me. After all, why would my parents leave me a note before I could read it? Kids still get picture books read to them, but now we all communicate in writing so much more often. Kids also are read text messages. For a kid to get a text message written directly for them and read directly to them, which they can reply to in some fashion, it teaches them something powerful about the written word, that it can be used to connect with the people you care about. End quote. I remember as a kid that I used to write stories on the family's typewriter before I could actually read or write. And it was just me typing nonsense, but, you know, it meant something to me. I was imitating what the grown-ups do and practicing it in some small way. And that's what kids are doing with emojis, but even deeper, both because of that call and response, but also because the little images have more meaning to them than letters they can't recognize yet. You know, they don't have to be able to read to recognize what a heart means. It's almost like baby sign language, a way for children to communicate before they're physically capable of speaking. Now they can text before they're able to read. Or maybe there really is a secret baby language, like in that Baby Geniuses movie, and they're all trying to warn us about some impending heart and digestive disease caused by unicorns coming out of the sky. Either way, I think we should listen to them. So this is a cool new finding about man's best friend. A team of researchers have found that dogs might use the Earth's magnetic field to navigate, an ability called magnetoreception. The team was made up of researchers from Czech University of Life Sciences, Virginia Tech, and Barry University, and based on prior research that indicated dogs might have an ability to sense the magnetic field because of their propensity to orient themselves north to south when doing their business. Which I had never heard before, and I kind of want to test. Like, I don't want to be the weirdo taking out my phone's compass next time I pass a dog relieving themselves on the sidewalk, but, like, I'm tempted. Anyways, in the new study, they conducted two experiments, which both involved putting GPS sensors on the dogs and releasing them to run around outside. In one experiment, there were 4 dogs, and in the other, there were 27, but in every case, the dogs quickly returned to the person who released them. Quoting phys.org, "In studying the routes the dogs took, both when heading out on an expedition and when returning, the researchers found they used one of 2 types of return. The first was called tracking, which meant a dog made its way back by following the same path it had taken out, presumably using its nose. The team called the other type of return scouting, because the dogs followed an unfamiliar path to get back to where they had begun their adventure. The researchers also found something else. For a large percentage of the scouting returns, the dogs first engaged in an odd behavior. They ran north-south along a 20-meter length a few times before heading back to their starting point. Doing so appeared to help the dogs get their bearings, as those that did it were more efficient in their return. The researchers suggest the north-south running is evidence of the dogs using the magnetic field to orient themselves in unfamiliar surroundings, which in turn helps them find their way home. Further testing involved the owner hiding as the dog made its trek, testing wind direction and speed, and noting the gender of the dog. No other factors made a difference in improving navigational efficiency, further supporting the idea that the dogs were able to use the Earth's magnetic field to navigate." End quote. A lot of different species have this magnetoreception ability, including mole rats, homing pigeons, cave salamanders, mollusks, and even domestic hens. But dogs are not currently part of the confirmed list, and scientists say there are probably a lot more species out there with this ability than we actually think. Speaking of dogs, with the powers of magnetoreception, perhaps we could finally answer one of the most pressing questions of the last 20 years. Who let the dogs out? The hottest hit of summer 2000, or at least the one you couldn't escape, winner of the 2001 Grammy for Best Dance Recording, and Rolling Stone's 3rd most annoying song of all time, the Baha Men's Who Let the Dogs Out? It's an earworm so simple that I was surprised to find out its origin story is a deep, complex web of mystery. For starters, it's basically a cover, and the Baha Men never claimed to have written it. In fact, they were originally hesitant to record it for that reason, and perhaps being doubtful how they could put their own spin on the track that they were covering. That track was 1998's soca-infused Doggy by Trinidadian artist Anselm Duggis. But that version had been covered by Jonathan King's band Fat Jack and His Pack of Pets. He turned it into a Euro techno track and added his own awful and appropriative Caribbean accent. Steve Greenberg, the Baha Men's manager, heard King's techno version and flat out told him it was the worst thing that he had ever heard. But Greenberg, who had recently been responsible for propelling Hansen to worldwide fame, knew the markings of a hit when he heard it, even if it was terrible. But how did King, the Fat Jack and His Pack of Pets guy who did the techno cover, even find out about the original Anselm Douglas version? That is thanks to his punk hairdresser, Keith Wainwright, who put the track on a mixtape he made upon returning from one of his regular visits to Trinidad and Tobago. And even if King has tried to take credit for the song eventually becoming a global hit thanks to the Baha Men version, Anselm Douglas can safely guard his ownership over the bulk of the song and its verses, which he claims are a staunchly feminist anthem. But the chorus, you know, the barking repetitions of who, 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 has even murkier origins. Quoting Mental Floss, Douglas admits that he originally heard the song's famous refrain from his brother-in-law, who once worked for a Canadian radio show. It just happened to be a jingle created by Patrick Stevenson and Leroy Williams, two producers who worked for that very station. As a result, Douglas was forced to acknowledge their input in an out-of-court settlement. Yet the year before that contested jingle, 20 Fingers, a tongue-in-cheek production team famed for their top 20 hit Short Dick Man, released You're a Dog, a handbag house anthem that utilized almost the exact same phrase. In 1992, teenagers Brett Hammock and Joe Gonzalez, aka Miami Boom Productions, penned a similar hook on the back of a Little Caesars bread bag. Their case for being the true originators is made even stronger by the evidence of two floppy disks filled with recordings of the Love to Hate chant, end quote. But it gets even wilder. Quoting again, a video taken at Austin's Reagan High School suggests its call and response was also first introduced in a much earlier sporting context, a football pep rally, way back in 1986, end quote. Now, if you were curious to unravel these origins even more, there is an entire feature-length documentary on this topic called, of course, Who Let the Dogs Out, which came out last year and, great news, is streaming on Hulu. The film heavily features a man named Ben Sisto, who spent 8 years trying to figure out the mysterious origins of the song. What makes this song so alluring? Why did it take off so incredibly despite how undeniably annoying it is? Sisto offers this analysis, quote, Baha Men's version opens a cappella. The vocals have a gravity that stops everything else in the room. Before having time to consider what Who Let the Dogs Out even means, the listener is transported to a world of pop, junkanoo, and barking that's both catching and annoying, head-bobbing and soul-screaming. It also seems people can't decide on exactly what the non-question means. What does it want from us? It's as if the uncertainty principle itself was a pop song. In a way, I think it's that confusion that hooks people. It sounds like Doritos taste. Unnatural, but undeniable. End quote. That is all for today. As always, this show is produced by Ride Home Media. I am Jackson Bird. I hope you all have a very good weekend, and I will talk to you on Monday.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.